Blog Talk Radio.
Afrofusion knocking. Shot Town keep rocking. D Money Midwest, let's go.
I did go to Chicago every third Saturday. When my DJ, they turn me on to good music. So this one day I day down, I try to keep my head down low. But the harder I try, so the more obvious it seems. The light is shining out, yeah. God, he done do am. Then of you quench am, yeah. He done slam, yeah. Motivated, yeah. Motivate me, 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 yeah. I run from the Midwest, I come go East Coast. Where the people then yappa like all of our rainbow. So this one day I go out town to try to keep my head down low. But the harder I try, what the more of your system. The light is shining out, hey, the people dance, yam. Then no be quench, yam, hey, my God, he done do, yam. Hey, motivate me, yeah. Motivate me, yeah. Motivate me, yeah. What you get in me day? I did throw a salute, so you go buy my grace too. Now so we they do, I'm the man, I'm the beat and the sweet and mellow. Green, white, green, I did rap from well. Now Midwest I did, but sometimes I did rock in my black and yellow. I did throw a salute, so you go buy my grace too. Now so we they do, I'm the man, I the beat and the sweet and mellow. Green, white, green, I did rock some well. Now Midwest I did, but sometimes I did rock in my black and yellow. Black and yellow. Black and yellow. Black and yellow. Black and yellow.
We want to welcome you to Black Wall Street USA for Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. I'm Sonia Cassandra Perdue, founder of CBBN, author of Black America, Asking Ourselves the Tough Questions, Book 1, 2010, and your co-host for this evening's show. Our host, Mr. Ron Carter, chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago, publisher of the South Street Journal, will be joining us shortly. The song was just a little bit different, wasn't it? That was Omo Go Reloaded, and he is a new member of Chicago's BlackBusinessNetwork.com, and he sent that over this week, and I enjoy that sound. It's a little bit different for me, but he sent me the words, so that helps me a little bit. And I can rock with that. I really can. You will be hearing more from Idris. That's his name, Idris Omo Go Reloaded. As a matter of fact, if you listen to the last show in our archives from Tuesday, March the 1st, you will hear a half an hour interview with Idris. Now, that's what we do for our members. We do all that we can to help them move to the next level of success. Come on over and join us today and touch the world. Plus, we're looking for new music. Visit our website for more information. Join us every Thursday evening right here for Black Wall Street USA. We're here from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Thursday evenings. We want you to be a part of what we do in sustaining and increasing black businesses across this country. The show has a national focus. We'll reach out to organizations and individuals across the nation in our efforts to connect the dots, the spiritual dots of our people across this land. We will bring forth ideas and agendas that are already in place. We will try to let the nation know what works in our communities. And this evening, Ron and I will talk business, but first we will talk history, our history and your history. Now, although the FBI now considers the murder of Emmett Till a closed case, in our hearts and minds, the circumstances of his death will never be closed in our memories. The issue will never be dead, for the more things change, the more they remain the same. I was born in 1955, the year of his death, so I don't, of course, remember all that took place that year, but Reverend Parker will be able to share that with us. And I don't remember the first time I heard the Emmett Till story, but I do know that I couldn't understand the why of it. I was confused as to why someone would die for whistling at a white woman. My grandmother explained it to me, and the pain, that pain has never left me at that point of recognition. It was a few Sundays ago when the case manager for the FBI, the president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and one of the physicians did a panel discussion on the autopsy findings of Emmett Till at the Chicago Cultural Center downtown in Chicago. The day that I watched, I guess, Reverend Wheeler Parker wipe the tears from his eyes as they showed the infamous picture of Emmett Till's battered body. That photo is 55 years old. Willa Parker, the cousin of Emmett Till, was with him the night that he was abducted in Mississippi. We appreciate him joining us this evening. And I'd like to say just one more thing about that Sunday afternoon. People, certain mentalities wish for us around this planet to pretend that we are colorblind, wish to say that we are all the same. We're not all the same. I can't be you, you can't be me. It just will never happen. On that Sunday before Reverend Parker came down into the general sitting area of the Chicago Cultural Center, someone else came along and approached me at the table that I was sitting at, relaxing and reflecting on the evening's event. It was a white man and his wife. They stopped and asked me, "Why are you so interested in the Emmett Till case?" And I was sort of taken aback. I was sort of angry a little bit, but I was really just caught off guard by the question. I thought they just stopped speak to me. And the question caught me off guard, and my reply back was, "I was born in 1955. I'm a black woman. This is my history." And his response was, "Oh, you were born in 1955? And so that's what I'm talking about. You can never be me. I can't be you because you will never, ever, 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 ever understand. For the more things change, the more they remain the same." We wanted to welcome you to Black Wall Street USA for Thursday, March 3rd, with that special guest, Reverend Willa Parker. You may also listen to a rebroadcast of this show at WJPC Chicago Saturday mornings, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. That's WJPC Chicago. Our call-in number is 347-326-9477. The chat room is open. Yes, I remember to open the chat room. Leave your company information and website links in the chat room. That's how we connect. If you'd like to speak to our guest, our host, or you have a question or comment, simply press the number 1. That lets us know that you want to come on the air. We'll say the last 4 digits of your telephone number, and we'll say you're on the air with Black Wall Street USA, and you will know that you're live. I'm Sonia Cassandra Perdue, founder of CBBN. Our guest is Reverend Parker. He's on the line. But first, let's welcome the chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago to the Internet Waves. Welcome to the show, Ron Carter. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Sonia. How about yourself this evening?
Doing great, doing great.
All right. Do you hear me nice and clearly?
I hear you very clearly, Mr. Carter. We want to take a few minutes here. We're going to bring Reverend Parker on the line. We're going to bring our guest on the line, and then because he does have another engagement appointment this evening, and after we speak to him, we're going to talk about Black Wall Street and all the things that's going on with Black Wall Street. Is that okay with you, Chairman?
That's okay. That's great.
Okay, let's welcome Reverend Willie Parker to the line. Reverend Parker, welcome to Black Wall Street USA.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Okay. Yes, Reverend Parker, it's my pleasure to, and my insightfulness to talk with you and to have you to be a guest. Black Wall Street is Black Wall Street on Chicago's Black Business Network. Is primarily a business radio program, but as we have witnessed what you have experienced, what your family have experienced, and from the years, what the United States has experienced regarding Emmett Till. You know, I mean, we've heard the story, and you have lived the story. What does that have to do with economics, if you can?
Well, economics has been a part of African Americans' life since they've been here, and the reason America has done as well as they have is because of the black slave labor and the black labor, cheap labor, and that's why they've done as well as they have, and it's always kept us farther behind.
Mm-hmm. So the case with Emmett Till, even as our name, Black Wall Street, really came from Tulsa, Oklahoma, where the same type of situation happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then probably many other places that we're not even aware of. Is there some type of psychological norm about white women, black men, and white men, and the whistle of white women, and this whole integration? And you lived it. Is that when you seen Emmett Till, based on when he whistled at this Caucasian woman, what was your thoughts when he did it, when you first noticed that he did that?
Well, when he first did it, we could not believe that he did it, and we would have never done anything like that in 1,000 years, and we were very alarmed. Emmett Till had no idea where he was and what he was dealing with, but we knew the South. I was born there, and he just didn't know anything about the racial mores that existed at the time.
Mm-hmm. Do you look at that as being a culture that has develop, or just plain old, what you call it, racism more or prejudice more of what happened?
I think it's a cultural develop. I think, go ahead. You want to finish?
Yeah, or more of institutional implementation of race. I'm not for sure. If you was a young teen at that time, now that you're an older, grown, and have experienced a lot, how do you view it then when it happened, and do you accept it now? I'm trying to get a feel of then and now based on your perception.
In terms of economics or in terms of racial things? Racial.
Both. And did what happened to Emmett Till, did it have any economic bearers to it, or was it just plain old prejudice, racism, or hatred? I don't know.
Well, it was racism that existed, and it just the way of life, and certain norms were set into place since they brought us to this country, and we were looked upon as second-class citizens. We're still not looked upon, and we still don't have that off the books yet about that. Four fifths, I believe it's called, and it always caused you to be the last, first to be fired and the last to be hired, and it always affected you economically because you were paid less. I remember at one time, white men with an eighth grade education made more than a college black man that had graduated from college. And so they controlled it. Mm-hmm. So that was in place, and it prevailed as much as possible even now. Same thing with women.
There is a, if I can, Sandra Perdue. She has a book that she asking blacks the tough questions. Did you ask Emmett Till that tough question at the time that he did that? Did you, a question of, do you know what you're doing or why you did that? Did you ask him that tough question?
No, the big thing that came out was Emmett Till's mouth. After he saw that we were alarmed and excited by what he did, the question was, do not tell my grandfather. That was the big question, and that was the discussion. So we promised him that we wouldn't tell. And as teenagers at that time, we kind of forgot about it. But as a young girl, I said, I know those people. This is not over. And so you're going to hear some more from this. So we didn't pay it any attention. So the question was not the question we're talking about, do not tell what happened.
So the murder happened, what, days or weeks after the whistle?
After the whistle, they came to the house 3 days later, and we think that he was killed at the same time. He whistled on a Wednesday. They came Sunday morning, and they found his body 3 days later on Wednesday.
So that was, was there any indications of what made them come 3 days later after the whistle?
Well, actually, when he whistled, the husband was out of town on taking care of some business, and when he came home and he was told about it, that's when he came. That's why it was 3 days later.
So, and you were in bed with him at the time that they came and got him?
When they came to the house, I was in the first bedroom. So I heard them talking outside.
But you seen them come in the house?
Yeah, they came to my bedroom first with a gun and a pistol, gun and a flashlight. And then they went to the next room where Emmett Till, the third room where he was at.
Before I go on, how do you feel? I'm pretty sure you have told this story many times. How do you feel somewhat kind of telling this story a lot?
Well, when it happened to Emmett, I didn't accept it that it was him, and I never had any remorse or sorrow. And I said, I'll always see him again. Now, when I tell it, every time we show the DVD, I don't know why. It didn't bother me then, but I cry. I just can't, you know, I don't understand it at all, but it really affects me now.
Did you know what was getting ready to happen to him when they took him from the house?
I felt when I heard them talking outside, I felt that I'm getting ready to die. Somebody's getting ready to die. I felt it very strongly. And I started praying. And I said, God, if you just let me get through this, I'll do what's right. And it affected my life this day and time. I am a minister, and I work with children and a pastor of the church that started Emmett Till's mother and grandmother's house in 1926. So it impacted me greatly.
How do you deal with it, even to the point that is it something today that as you walk down the street and no one knows who you are, is there something that as you will walk down the street or you have walked down the street that reminds you of what happened then?
When I see different races, when I see black and I see white, I'm constantly reminded. I'm constantly aware of the way situations are, because you're constantly reminded every hundred in some way or other that you are black. And once you got one drop of black blood in you, and I tell the white kids that when I go to schools, I said, if they come out tomorrow, you have one drop of black blood in you, your life will change forever. And that's something we have to live with. And you can't forget it, even with the changes and improvements. You can't forget that.
Do you, when the Chicago Defender, I think it was the Chicago Defender or Ebony Magazine, first of all, did you see his photograph prior to it being printed publicly?
I did at the film. I saw him at the funeral. It looked like a monster. I mean, to me, there was not Emmett in the casket, you know, so you can't have any whole lot of feelings for Emmett at that time because it's not him, you know. And I don't know if I was in a state of shock. Still don't know why I felt that way, but I just didn't accept the fact that there was Emmett. I said, I'll see him later, and I hope to someday.
Did the community... You know, again, this here is something that happened, it's been a cold case, as Sanja indicated, but during the process that it was a cold case, and you somewhat kind of living this cold case before the murders been brought to justice. They was brought to justice in what year?
September 1955.
Yeah, I'm talking about, but they was brought to justice just recently.
Oh, you mean when they opened up the case to do the investigation?
Right, and he was found guilty what year?
Sir, but what happened is they confessed. Remember, they confessed about a few months later. So there was never in the trial. They opened up the case just to do the investigation. The FBI did. Of course, back then, they wouldn't touch it at all. They could not prosecute. Only people could prosecute was the state of Mississippi, and it had to be in that district, Tallahatchie County District. Those were the only people that could prosecute, and it was a black judge there, and she said they didn't find enough information to bring anybody to trial because the guys that did it, they have long been gone. They have been long dead.
So they
confessed right after, made about $4,000 for their story to the Look magazine.
Mm-hmm. So, well, from the time that all of that happened to the date that 71st Street was claimed Emmett Till Drive, was that any satisfaction, or have you had any type of relief based on the historical time frame from the day that it happened till now? Was there something that happened historical that gave you some sense of relief, what you have witnessed?
Well, we're still waiting for closure. It's not completely closure until you know exactly what happened. But those kind of things play a part in the Till Bill. I guess you know about the Till Bill. That's a bill that has been signed into law by President Bush, and President Obama allocated $11 million per year for 10 years to pursue cases that date back from 1970 and before 1970. So that gives you some sense to know that we have changed some and that Emmett still speaks from the grave.
Okay, and how old was he when this happened to him?
14.
Mm-hmm. So, as you look at the civil rights and the movements and the even if we can look at the many people cried when Barack Obama became president. And some people cried for almost free at last, and some people cried because justice at last. Some people cry for I don't believe it. Have there been a sense of something historically that has happened to you that gave you a sense of at last regarding Emmett Till?
You know what bothers me? The plebeian, the common people, everyday people. I look at our situation, and we have regressed to the point where we only have, in most cities, less than 50% of African Americans graduate from high school. Some cities only 30%, and there's no outrage. My heart is very sad, and those are things that really, really grassroots things that really concerns me. So I sure appreciate the fact that Obama got to be elected president. But I'm working on the streets. I'm working down at the bottom, and things are not good at all.
If I can kind of piggyback on what you stated, let me ask you your age again.
Beg your pardon?
What's your age?
I'll be 72 March 18th.
Well, being 72 years old and what you have witnessed in life to this date, and you can make a statement that things are not good at all, how can you, or are you comparing your youth dealing with what you had to deal with, such as what happened to Emmett Till, to how you are on the streets today? Is there a fair comparison, or are you saying that back then your youth was a little bit better than the youth today?
What I am saying is that the opportunities that exist now, if my father had had the opportunities that we have today, he'd be a much, much better person. The opportunities now, what has happened is that we lost our home. We lost our families. Back then, we had 85% of American families headed by two people. Now we've left it basically to the women, and it's just, it's disastrous. And it seems like we that are at the top, people who are doing well, they don't see it. There's no outrage among us, and nobody can save us from us but us. I had a meeting last night with black men. We're trying to get black men together out here in Summit, Argo, Illinois, to address these issues. They're there, and it's not getting better for us. It's getting worse. The dropout rate, if you drop out of school, what chance do you have, you know? That bothers me.
What do you contribute that to? I mean, let's say that back then, yes, there were more of a family structure, and it was more of a two-family households, and compared to now. But what do you think happened that our family structure has fallen apart, and you kind of look at today, even to the point that the education probably wasn't as more astute then as it is now, but you still look at our education level is not in parity to the education of achievement back then. Why is that? Why do you say that is? And based on your experience being a 72-year-old man.
Well, being a pastor, and I look at it from probably a different perspective than you or others would, I say the church has failed. The church has not done. We as ministers and pastors, we have not done what we could have. I mean, everything in the black community basically worked through or depended on the church, and we have failed. We have failed. We need to have some outrage. We need to have some outcry. So we fought for a lot of social changes, and we tend to have made some. Well, we did make gains in those things, but we left our family behind, illiteracy, and seeing to our kids getting the education they got. We so busy with ourselves sometimes we just left those things behind, and I think that's definitely what happened. We didn't carry the whole thing along. We went for the top and we left the others behind. We didn't take them along with us.
So, again, if I can take advantage of your age,
mm-hmm.
you have seen, you know, again, when you was 14 years old,
mm-hmm.
compared to the 14 today,
mm-hmm.
you were 14 years old, more afraid of white racists,
mm-hmm.
and the 14 today is afraid of their peers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, is that planned institutional type of Willie Lynch syndrome? Or have the black community allowed that transformation to happen to them themselves?
I think it's both. I think the system gave our women money, and they gave them more illegitimate children they had, the more money they gave them. So that said, really they tried to fix it so that a black woman really didn't need a black man for economics, because that was taken care of. Maybe sexually, but economically they didn't need them. So the system, when I look at the system, I said, they did not help us. They put us in a bad position. And I know they gave us things, but you just can't keep giving people things without some kind of responsibility for accountability. So that knocked the black man, I feel, out of the equation, except for certain things. But I think that was definitely one of the big things. And then we as a people, like I said, nobody can, Jesse Jackson always said, nobody can save us from us but us. We needed to stay focused and make sure that our boys were training properly. The men are supposed to be the head. Innately, in a man, he wants to be the head. And most African-American women, if they're not careful, they have to marry down. And when you marry down, it's going to create a conflict most of the time in most families, because you got a woman that's with a college degree and you don't have one, and she's making more money probably, and it creates havoc.
Well, yeah, I remember when I was a kid growing up in Robert Taylor Homes, and I used the story of whenever this young white lady came in a project, all the men scattered. And I always wondered why my father had his clothes in my closet, and he always go hide in the bed when this white lady come knocking on the door. Mm-hmm. And then I always wondered why, when this white lady came in the neighborhood, all the men go across the street and stand in front of the liquor store. Mm-hmm. So I finally got aware of that. But as I became aware of that institutional racism that is being developed on our family structure, and you indicated the role of the church have not been doing all that it could. And naturally, you know, so you being a minister and you making a statement like that, how do you accept that, you know, as you being a minister? You a minister, you saying that the church is, the black church has not done all they could, and yet we still seeing the problem even increasing in, even more. And you are almost saying that what you experienced as a kid is with Emmett Till is not as greater than what the 14 years olds are experiencing now. Is, if I'm on point,
or
I'm off point. What's happening?
Well, you're on point. I feel that back then under racism, we made more progress. We are regressive. We made more progress under those hard taskmasters. And we, I don't know, for some reason we forced ahead. But now, like you said, we're afraid of each other. We just destroying ourselves, right? I mean, we, of all crimes, basically, is black on black. Very seldom does a racial crime or rape go outside of the race. And there's nobody, what bothers me, there's no outrage among African-American leaders. No outrage. All right, it's falling apart, and you can't deny that. You see it, the statistics are there. Sure, we can blame the system, but the system's not going to be for you anyway. The system is there. But we have a responsibility. We did greater, to me, for what we had to work with back then than we are doing now, with all the opportunities we have, percentage-wise.
Well, again, if I can reflect on the name of our organization, Black Wall Street, as it came from Tulsa, Oklahoma, in which, again, the destruction of Tulsa, Oklahoma, Black Wall Street, is because of a black man making some contact with a white woman, which resulted in Tulsa, Oklahoma, being destroyed. Is it too much to say that integration, whether it is integration economics or integration based on black men going for white women, have resulted in our destruction?
That's a very involved, complex question, but I think you can see a little bit of all of it in there, you know. We just got twisted. We got off base. We lost our focus from the time. I'm 72 years old in a couple of weeks, and our goals, when I was 14, I became a barber. I was a barber for 55 years, when Sun Times became a newspaper, I was at one of the first papers. Business person. I bought as a kid. I bought wholesale and I sold retail. And my mother made me go to the bank. My mother was there. Made me go to the bank every week. I had to go to the bank. Got saved. So I developed that habit. I became addicted. And we don't have that anymore. It's just gone. This is what we had. We tried to set people up, children up with bank accounts. And if they came to the meeting, we're going to start them off with so much money, cash money out of our pockets. I think one or two kids came, family, just one or two. It is sad.
So this is an activity that you're involved in now, and as you just pointed out, you are working with getting youth to go open a bank account with your own money to get them
mm-hmm.
started, and you're still mm-hmm. having a hard time for the youth to participate?
Yes, yes, for sure. I said we only got two people to come out.
What did you advertise free money?
Yeah. It's only 1,100 black people out here.
And you advertise free money to open up a bank account and you got a response
yeah.
of two people?
Yeah, you can't put the money in your pocket now. You got to go in the bank.
Yeah, right. Well, still
that
free
means
money.
You're not going to see it.
Well, but
you have to be geared to saving and thinking about the future. Because at first when I started saving, I said, I don't want to save no money for 40 years from now. That was my thinking. But my mother said, you go in the bank every week. She made me. I didn't have a choice. And I don't regret it.
Okay, well, then maybe your problem as far as recruiting is that the parents of today is not the parents that you had.
True, and the parents were not there. These are grandparents tend to be the family basis. The parents, a lot of the parents have substance abuse problem or they're not there. In almost 90% of the case, the fathers are not there. So we're trying to do something about that right now. We're trying
mm-hmm.
to get fathers. We got what we call a dad's class. We're trying to get dads back involved with their children and give them the same opportunity and chance. It made a difference. My dad was there. And it made a difference when my dad spoke.
And tell me something about Summit, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you are now?
I'm in Summit. It's called Summit, Argo, Illinois. Summit, it was two towns. The Argo come from Argo, Starch, Missoula, on cable service. Summit annexed Argo in 1911. So now you could use either name. And we have about 10,000 people out here. And we have about 1,100 of them African Americans. 70% of our town now is Hispanics. So we are about a half mile wide, a mile and a half long. And we're right at 63rd in Harlem. And right there down from Midway Airport. African Americans have been here since the early 1900s. I came here in 1947 from Mississippi. And it's always been a viable place. You got the manufacturing companies here. So we always had a little cluster of African Americans that, you know, came out and lived from Mississippi, Arkansas.
So what's the population again?
10,000 total.
10,000 and a percentage of black?
1,100. We always ran about 10%, that's all.
Okay. So, and that's where you still, is there a difference of cooperation based on your involvement with the youth? Or is it basically the same as if you was here in the city?
It's probably better here, I would think, because we don't have the shooting, we don't have the violence, the crime of such. I mean, your grandmother could walk the alleys all night, nobody going to jump or anything. Drugs are here, definitely drugs are here. So if everybody know everybody, so if somebody break in your house this morning, you're going to find out who did it before the day is gone. So it's that kind of thing. But the crime, everything's, you know, our kids are not graduating from school. That's what bothers me. They're not getting that education that they should, and that's terrible when you got young men. And just dropping out of school, I don't know, it makes me want to cry.
Well, how do, historically looking, do people know who you are? And upon them knowing who you are, what is their reaction? And is there a certain age element that relates to who you are?
Well, you know, in the Bible, it said prophet is without honor in his own country. I don't call myself a prophet, but you know, you Black Wall Street, people know you, say, yeah, that's all. Carter, Brother Carter, you know, it's kind of like that. And, you know, if they go somewhere and somebody talk about Emmett Till, they say, oh yeah, we know Emmett Till's or Thug, and blah blah. But here, you know, everybody know everybody, and we got some pretty respectable kids, pretty respectable. So we know their parents and the grandparents. We know everybody. Everybody, 1,100 people. You know everybody. Plus, I was a town barber for 55 years.
Oh yeah, so you got in everybody's business, didn't you?
Yeah, I know everybody. I know everything.
So, what is the youngest youth can relate to Emmett Till? Well, I mean, what age can a say, huh? Who is that? Or what age is more the coming of what age can relate to who Emmett Till is? And how young would you go down that Emmett Till name is very vague? You understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, I was in Atlanta, Georgia last week, and I spoke at 3 middle schools. The one school I asked who didn't know Emmett Till, and I think most of the kids did in the class did not know, never heard of Emmett Till. So in
okay,
this
middle
town,
school, have, what age is that about?
That would be like from 7th and 8th, junior high.
Okay. Did not know who Emmett Till was, okay?
Right. I was just surprised that some of them knew because the teacher had taught them, but they those things do not impact them like it would be in the history. It's just that's not there, you know, like it should be. So
okay.
Here.
Mm-hmm. Can you take a? Well, I know you got to go pretty shortly. Can you take one call before we kind of close you out? Can you do that?
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm, no
okay.
Problem.
Sonia?
Good evening. You listen to Black Wall Street USA with host Ron Carter, chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago. I'm his co-host this evening, Sonia Cassandra Perdue. Our guest this evening is what Reverend Willie Parker, part of our history, part of the Emmett Till story. We're going to go to area code 301 before Mr. Parker has to leave us. Area code 301, you're on the line with Black Wall Street USA. Who are you and what's your comment?
Yeah, this is B.A. calling from Maryland, and thank you, Sonia. Thank you, Ron. Good
hey,
evening.
How are you doing again, bro?
Great. Good evening, Reverend Parker.
Good evening.
Yes, I'm 42 years old, born in 1968. Born and raised in the city of Detroit. And for me, growing up, and even today as I reflect on what I was taught, and of course I did learn of Emmett Till roughly in my teenage years, but I must say that growing up in the city of Detroit, Emmett Till, the Little Rock Nine, the bus boycott in Montgomery, it really didn't have a major impact on me because the reason for take Emmett Till for example, I know boys who met similar fates at the hands of black people.
Yes,
it's sad to say that, sir, but I've seen those type of bodies. Things happen, but let me say it's my understanding with Emmett Till that when the white men came and grabbed Emmett Till out of the house, that there were people in the car, black people included. And even I'm told that from one documentary that the woman that Emmett allegedly whistled at was in the car to identify that was Emmett.
Uh-huh.
And in my that's an accessory. You know,
uh-huh.
Particularly when you know what's about to happen. It was my understanding that blacks that gave Emmett up told where the boy lived and how to find him and whatnot. Those are accessories, and that was the case. My understanding is about, you know, trying to get the case, get those other people tried for murder as well. Because, again, if you know that these hooligans are what they're capable of, and it appeared that many people in that town knew what they were capable of doing. I don't know. I don't know. It's a sad situation. It was a sad jury. One of our congressmen was down there, Congressman Charles C. Diggs from Detroit, was as an observer. The take-home message today is a difficult one for me. It is a difficult one because of what we're doing to each other, Reverend Parker. It's difficult.
It's sad.
Well,
you know,
how can you address his points, Reverend Parker, based on the accessory to the crime, based on blacks present having the insight or possible the insight of what was getting ready to happen? Did they know and did they point him out of where he lived?
Yes, and you have to go back to the times and understand the times. And it's going to be him or them. They worked for this man, and we are sure that that blacks were involved. I met a girl in Germany, 1960s, and she said her husband, Tutar Collins, was involved. Not her husband, her uncle. And she said they had him to help, so he lost his mind behind that. You have to really understand the times that happened then. And I like one thing he said, we suffer more at our own hands. There was a sign that once said that African Americans, I think, killed so many thousand a year, whereas Ku Klux Klan killed 6 or 7. We're not enraged about that. It doesn't bother us, and that bothers me. We have a perplexing situation and condition that we need to do something about.
And one other question, and that'll be it, sir, if you don't mind, Reverend Parker, a present-day question. And I'm with you 100% on education. I am with you. And I'm trying to. It's, I don't know. We nothing is surprising to me. Meaning the joblessness in our community is predictable, as you stated. If you don't have a high school diploma, and you need, of course, much more than that, and something else. And I don't mean to be dividing the people or whatever. On top of that, on top of the fact that our young people are being incarcerated and not getting education and so forth and so on, which is bad enough. You get, I don't know, anywhere between 10 and 40 million illegal immigrants yearning for an opportunity too through the DREAM Act and so forth and so on. So, you know, you it's only so many jobs, only so many means of being productive. If that happens, if the Hispanics come here with their work ethic, and they take the minimum skill jobs,
uh-huh.
I don't know. I'm trying to tell my people, what are y'all gonna do? And
yeah.
Unfortunately,
the
I'm not
jobs
getting the
we
response.
Left, they took, and we can't. We won't go back to them. We just don't go backwards. But the jobs that we took, other people brought back and took them and put us out on the street.
Yeah, and I know in Chicago, you know, that Boeing just got a $35 billion contract from the Air Force. Mm-hmm. There was a time when black people were really in the Air Force. We were really, you know, at the turn of the century with Bessie Coleman, they were part of and the Tuskegee Airmen, they were part of a black aviation club, a black aviation organization.
Right.
I mean, $35 billion coming to Boeing. And I'm asking a question for Chicago. Anyway, you know, what is our involvement in that? You mean to tell me with taxpayer dollar you get $35 billion to build these tankers, these flying tankers to refuel these jets, and African-Americans, what piece of that do we find ourselves with? You know, but I'm continuing to strive, continuing to push. I got programs here in Maryland, and you know, I have a business, of course. So you know, I don't only focus on African Americans. I do all I can, but we got some difficult days ahead, as Dr. King said. You know, thank you, Reverend Parker. I appreciate it.
God bless you.
We appreciate you always coming and calling in on our program. You know, you're always insightful, helping me to sit back and think when you make your comments as well. So, Reverend, we're at this point where I think that you do have to make a run.
Yeah, I'm grabbing my coat now.
Okay. Well, look, we want to have you back on. We also, maybe if you want to drive down 63rd Street and make a left on 43rd on Cottage Grove, and then come to our summit that's going to be on 43rd right off Lake Park. We'd love to have you there. That's going to be March the 26th. We'd love to have you at our summit. And
that's
how
on,
our...
That's on Saturday.
Pardon?
That's on a Saturday, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Because there is a relationship to economic development, to the social genocide as it relates by ourselves or other people. And we have to be reminded of that. So again, I want to thank you for coming on our program, and we do look forward to you coming back, and let's make it happen.
Okay, thank you very much. God bless you, and keep the faith.
Thank you again.
All right, bye.
Bye now. Sonia Perdue.
Yes, sir, I am here. What a great interview, and we certainly do appreciate Reverend Parker for taking the time out of his schedule to join us this evening. He's on his way out the door, but we appreciate it that he did stop to be with us this evening. For me, it's an historical moment. For me, it is very important. You listen to Black Wall Street USA on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Sonia Perdue, founder of CBBN, your co-host for this evening's show. We'll be right back after this break with our host, Ron Carter, to take your calls and give you an update on what's going on with Black Wall Street USA and Chicago's Black Business Network. Stay with us, please.
Culture, why we can't go outside and play today?
Baby, because there's too much happening out there. We got misguided people in this world who turn to violence and use guns, and sometimes innocent people like you and me get caught in the middle of it.
Well, what's wrong with them?
Baby, I don't know. They need change in the life.
Yeah.
back, and you're listening to Black Wall Street USA on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Sonya Cassandra Perdue, founder of CBBN, and our host, Ron Carter, will be back with us shortly to take your calls and give you an update on what's going on with Black Wall Street. When we were last on the air, it was before the election, and Dr. Patricia Watkins, was the candidate for mayor, was our guest, and Mr. Omar Sharif, founder of the African American Contractors Association, was with us. Mr. Sharif was here to answer the tough questions about where are the construction jobs for our communities. We want to reach out to both of them and thank them for their time, and we look forward to talking to them again after the election, and we look forward to talking to Mr. Sharif because we surely want to go back into that conversation again, and repeatedly we want to reach out to them to call us and be a part of what we do. Black Wall Street USA is the official broadcast of Black Wall Street National thanks to the support of the National Office, and we're hoping that we get a call from the National President this evening, Michael Carter, to tell us what's going on with Black Wall Street across the nation and the upcoming national convention. You can listen to our shows at blackwallstreetdistrict.com. We have a big logo there right on that page. That's blackwallstreetdistrict.com. You can also listen to the rebroadcast of the show at WJPC Chicago, Saturday mornings from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. That's www.wjpcchicago.com. And during the week, you can really listen to some great music because I do listen to WJPC Chicago. This is Black Wall Street USA. Our calling number is 347-326-9477. The chat room is open. Leave your company information and website links in the chat room. That is how we connect. Press the number one if you'd like to speak to our host or you have a question or comment. CBBN on Blog Talk Radio is also on the air Tuesday evenings with the CBBN members show. That's at 6:30 p.m. That's where we permit our members to come on the air, share their visions and business plans, and promote themselves. That's what we do for our members. The Consumer Show is on the air Tuesdays at 7:30 p.m. with attorney and CPA Derek McNeil. Now, Mr. McNeil was not on the air this Tuesday, but Mark S. Allen and I had some great dialogues, and you can listen to that show in our archives. Join us every Thursday evening right here for Black Wall Street USA. We're here 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Thursday, and we invite you to be a part of sustaining and increasing black businesses across the country. Now, next week, let's talk about our upcoming guest for next week. Next Thursday, which is March 10th, at the same time, 7 p.m., Mr. Shaka Barak, president of the Marcus Garvey Institute, will be our guest. Mr. Barak has served as president since 1992. I know they pronounce his name all kind of ways. The institute has set up a traveling art exhibit used in lectures on Marcus Garvey's achievements, especially in big business such as shipping, corporations, manufacturing, grocery stores, and restaurants. They've traveled to universities, museums, festivals, and other businesses across this country. And we want to hear more about what's going on with that exhibit, what's going on with the Marcus Garvey Institute, and the reaction to the history of Marcus Garvey. As Reverend Parker just shared with us, there, you know, when he asked of the middle grades, when he was down in Atlanta speaking to these three middle schools, how many of you know Emmett Till? Know the story of Emmett Till, in other words, know our history. And there were very few who knew. In other words, in 2011, they're not really teaching black history, are they? Also, probably the reaction would be the same if you asked who was Marcus Garvey. And not only other young people, ask a room of older people if they know who Marcus Garvey is. So we want to be sure that we reach out to him. We appreciate him taking the time. Also, I want him to tell us his experiences as traveling from town to town to town as he looks at black economics in different places. Remember, we say this show has a national focus, and that's what we want to hear about. Those are the things that we want to talk about. We are connecting the dots. CBBN will host a business meeting. I'm going to talk about events for a moment or two. This business planning meeting is open to the public. It will be on Saturday, March the 12th, 2011, from 2:30 p.m. to 4 p.m. We ask that you join us for this meeting with other CBBN members to discuss upcoming events and programs. This event will be at the King Branch Library, located at 35th and King Drive, right here in Chicago. Matter of fact, it's our first business planning meeting because I can't do it by myself. I want to form a team. I want to make this a success. I want the collaboration of the members. We have 700-plus members now to make these upcoming events a benefit for not only the members but also the community. Our theme for 2011 is let's talk about nothing but success in 2011. Let's talk about nothing but success in 2011. Our discussion will include the following items. Upcoming job fair in April and May, we're going to produce those. Real job fair with real jobs. Wouldn't that be a surprise? Upcoming business expo in October 2011. Jobs training and services for youth program outreach. I am in the process of developing jobs training and services for youth program. It has always been one of our functions. And part of the business planning meeting is going to be how you and your organization can participate in this program. We want to talk about collaboration with other organizations in ways that strengthen all of our bases and permit us to move to the next level of success. And we have some other things in the work, but we'll talk about those activities at the upcoming meeting. That's Saturday, March 12th, 2:30 to 4 p.m. I can't do it by myself. My list of things to do is about 1,000. So call me at 312-239-8835. 312-239-8835 to RSVP. Leave me your email address, please, so we can stay connected. And if you'd like to be on an upcoming show, please also let me know. A number of members, as part of our profile, said that, yes, they would like to be on an upcoming show. So give me a call and let me know, and we'll start with scheduling ahead now. Wow, isn't that great? And we want to book you into one of our upcoming shows. You're listening to Black Wall Street USA. I'm Sonia Cassandra Perdue, founder of CBBN and author of Black America Asking Ourselves the Tough Questions, which you can purchase on Amazon.com. Let's welcome our host back to the show. Ron Carter, you're back on the air. So, how was that interview with Mr. Parker?
Let me tell you, it was historical for me. You know, there are many questions that we, you know, could have asked as it relates to his personal feelings, but that definitely was historical for me, and give me a great privilege to ask someone that actually who's witnessed that. But I believe that the our caller from Maryland, he kind of was probably related to today, that the youth today see that happen to them, to themselves. They see their, you know, matter of fact, we see it on TV a lot now from these cell phones, people getting beat up right in the middle of the street. And it just so happens that when we see that, it is black on black opposed to white on black or black on white. And so we see that every day, and sometimes maybe we sometimes get immune to it, as the youth today not only see it in the movies, but I've been told that the video games, the violence in the video games are making almost as much money as the movies are making. And so have we have the youth today say, so what? I see it every day. But personally for me, it gives me, I don't know if the right term is an honor to interview him based on something real, happened real sad, but that's something that happened that was exposed to the public because so many times it has happened and has not been recorded. Yeah, I do definitely want to have him back. And I guess definitely is the line of my questions was trying to get a feel of our sociological type of mentality as it relates to economics. Is that the whites that did that to Emmett Till, did they do it to suppress blacks or... I think I said one time before when I was a kid, when I grow up, I'm not going to have to deal with this racism because all the white races are going to be dead. So I don't have to deal with it. But it seems as though they have taught their children well, and we have not taught our children well as far as what happened to Emmett Till. And as it says in the Jewish community, never again, as they continue to tell their children. And sometimes we try to hide the truth from our children. So we do get that Willie Lynch syndrome that still haunts us, as well as our convenience of not having to identify with being black. I don't know if all that. So I think I got all of that from that interview and a lot more that we did not talk about. So the history still remains with us. And there are many people that are still here that have witnessed that horrible part of history. Even as we look at Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, as they indicate in the movie, in the documentary, Before They Die. So those that have actually been through the 1921s, the 1950s, the 1960s, they're still alive, and they have their stories, but their stories are not being told to the point that our children do not use those stories as a sense of strength of the black race, opposed to a sense of being degraded. So, again, to me, I got a lot out of that interview. There was a lot more that I can talk about. And, again, the Reverend was no, you know, he was a minister and a barber and active in the community. But he wasn't putting himself on a pedestal to be above. He indicated he still have his flashbacks of what happened when he was 14 years old to now he's 72 years old. He still carries that history with him. Our caller indicated, you know, in other documentaries that probably would not have happened to Emmett Till if some blacks kept their mouths shut. And then Reverend Parker indicated, well, that was different times. Some blacks had to open their mouths because they worked for those same people that killed Emmett Till. So it tells a lot of different stories, a lot of different things that was going on where you know, like even today, blacks today said, if I was a slave, I'd be dead today. But there were a lot of slaves that are dead because they refused to be a slave. And there were many slaves that were killed. I think that there was a number about, I think over 2 million Africans that came from Africa here were killed because they refused to be a slave. Now, many more did come across that accept being a slave, but the story of, if we could say, Amistad, you know, there was many stories like that where they refused to be a slave. And there were many cases where some blacks probably would not accept Emmett Till being taken by white folks out of their home. I mean, Reverend Park at the time was 14 years old. Do he just sit back and watch? Was there other blacks that seen these white guys take Emmett Till away from the house? Did they just watch? And so there's so many different things that happened then, and how do we reflect them today? So it means a lot of things to me, and a lot of different questions of our social conditioning. What were your thoughts, Sonia?
You're listening to Black Wall Street USA. I'm Sonia Perdue. You're listening to our host, Ron Carter, chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago, and he's reflecting on the interview earlier in the show with Reverend Willa Parker, who is the cousin of Emmett Till, who was murdered in 1955. You covered a lot of ground there, Ron, a lot of ground on that one question. Let me touch bases on a couple of things. I said in the introduction to Reverend Parker that during that symposium down at the Chicago Cultural Center, when I turned and looked at him, because I didn't know who Reverend Parker was, I would not have recognized him, because at the beginning of the discussion, he was sitting in the first row of the audience with a group of other men. But when they put that picture of Emmett Till up, his battered body, I saw this black man wiping his eyes. 55 years later, looking at that picture, still moves him because it moves me. And so it doesn't go away. It never goes away. And no one can understand it better than him and those people that were involved at that time. Now, also during that symposium, they indicated that most of the people, almost all of the people who were there then are dead. So it made the cold case very difficult to follow up on. A lot of the evidence and a lot of the information was destroyed. But you can only get this insight from talking to him personally to know that he met someone in Africa who had been part of the roundup of Emmett Till, and that person had lived with that regret to the point that it had destroyed their mind and their hearts too, I'm sure. So there were a lot of people involved, and everyone had to live with this, and that's an interesting story in itself. Even the white people, the black people, the town, the people who watched him being taken, the people who lived through that week and after that in that town, that's an interesting story in itself as to how do you live with that happening. And so that's one of the things that I got out of that. He was very straightforward about the children of that time, and because of his involvement, and I understand he does travel a lot. I did talk to him down in Atlanta. I understand that he does travel a lot, and he speaks a lot of places, and what he sees saddens him, and he probably feels because he alone can do nothing about it. That's how tremendous our socioeconomic problems are. He alone cannot do anything about it, and I've asked this question too about different things, and in my book and out of my book, where is the outrage? Where is the outrage about what's happening in our community and what's going on with our young people? Also, you mentioned, you came back to something else about the violence in the videos. horrible violence. Horrible. I don't know if you've been on any of those video games. I have been on one or two of them. Horrible violence, horrible killing, repeatedly. You get points for killing. Your score goes up for how many people you can kill, how bloody the room is, and can you survive the killing, which we know in real life, no one does. No one survives that. But I use this example, and I've used this example before. I used to listen to Tupac. I liked Tupac. I really did. I had, you know, I was probably in my 40s. So I wasn't listening to him when he was alive, but someone gave me a tape. Yeah, he's good. You should listen to him. And he was good. And the words, he was genius. Yes, he was. He was genius. But his words were violent. They were very aggressive. His music was. And I had started putting the tape in my car and driving downtown to work to Royal Bank of Canada. I'm already aggressive. And I would listen to that, and I would be more aggressive. I had to literally stop listening. I have never listened to him again. Because it was raising my level of aggression. So just from that experience, that one experience, I myself can testify that you are affected. I was learning the words to it and bopping to it and this. I said, oh, now, hold on. Let's hold on. He is good. But just from that basic experience through that short period. So if this is on and on and on, day after day after day, can you imagine the insanity going on in someone's head, playing those games, listen to violent music? Is there any wonder why people have just lost their minds? It's that programming, it's that feeding, and I felt that aggression, and I had to pull back from it because I was just too assertive, you know. It calmed down a little bit, plus the coffee. So that's very, very much, if that isn't cured, and you can't tell everybody what to listen to. You're not going to control what everybody listens to. And our generation, the generation before us, had problems with our music. Their generation before that had problems with their music and dancing. But was it as violent? Was the violence there? It was I think they were more concerned about the sex and the romance and the moving and twisting of the body a little bit more. But was the violence in the music, beating people, killing people, shooting people, the violence was not in that music, okay? They were getting in trouble in other ways, okay, becoming sexually aggressive. So without changing the majority of what they listen to, I don't think you're going to change anything. I don't think you're going to change it at all. And that's one of the points I wanted to come to. Yes, I am so appreciative of Reverend Parker being here. For me, that is living history. It is something that you just can't, I can almost not put it in words what I feel meeting him and him being a part and coming over. And I'm hoping that he really, really does come over and be a part of the Black Wall Street Summit on March 26th. I want you to talk a few minutes about what's going on with Black Wall Street Chicago. Our national chairman was on the line. I told him to be patient, but he's gone. He'll be back in a few minutes, probably answering his phone. He wants to talk about the national convention. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with Black Wall Street Chicago until he comes back to us?
Yeah, we're going to kick some feet.
Is that right? And what does that mean, Chairman? What's going on?
We mad as hell and we ain't gonna take no more.
You know,
I guess that as you kind of reflect to the violence and how it does have an influence in one's thinking and behavior, to me, the lack of parity and equality for blacks in the economics of the city of Chicago and around this country is my aggression. It's the aggression that keeps me moving with Black Wall Street and knowing that our agenda is true and it must be carried out. So with that in mind, Black Wall Street had a committee meeting earlier today, this morning, every Thursday morning at 8:30. We have our committee meeting, and the first of the month we have our board meeting. And as I relate to Reverend Parker, giving what you stated about violence and giving our direction of Black Wall Street, to me, it brings things to a head that the agenda of Black Wall Street is, to me, the ultimate of what we need to be about other than our worship and belief in God. After that belief and after that serving of God, I believe our direction is to do exactly what Black Wall Street is doing. It's sickening to me how our leadership in Chicago has abandoned its role and responsibility. And it makes me feel, I don't know if many of you or our listeners, let me ask you, Sonia, have you seen the movie Braveheart?
Yes, I have. I believe that's with Mel Gibson.
Correct. And
not that
movie,
I remember it, but go ahead.
Okay, in the movie Braveheart, it was the Scottish trying to get their freedom from the English. And as hard as the Scottish fought to be free from English control and oppression, their hardest fight was with their noble Scottish leaders. And every time they get a handle on having victory for their people, the noble Scottish people came in and to manipulate the process, to put that process back. And that is what I see that has been taking place here in Chicago. So we're getting a lot of mixed messages, but even with all those mixed messages, Black Wall Street, I believe, is the most clear definition of black empowerment that exists in Chicago and, for that matter, in the United States. Because there is the other ethnic groups that have all the ingredients. They have their language, they have their culture, they have their geographical location, and then they have their sense of value that keeps them in a lock on the issues. We don't have that luxury, but. And we don't have that luxury because we have that part of the Braveheart movie where our leadership as noble people are used to divide us, to keep us separated. And I always call that is being organized to be disorganized. So that's what I believe that we're up against here in Chicago with Black Wall Street. And as we do so, our meeting today, we focus on putting our summit together for March 26th. And as we work to pool the resources to address our 16 Black Wall Street districts, our parity of contracts, our government oversight to make sure we're getting our fair share of government money to implement our programs. As we talk about black contractors in the neighborhood, we are focused with our agendas for the summit. And as we are focused for that, we still have to move on to our internal development to keep our gender focused. So we're moving fast. We're moving steady toward our summit on February 26th. And then on our reception, it was going to be, on March 26th, and our reception was going to be on May 19th, here at March 19th, here at our office. And so what we're doing is just keeping our gender real focused. I just have to say that I still have reflections listening to Reverend Parker as he told the story, and there's many stories came out of that interview. And of all those stories, have a lot to do with the many agendas that we have today, especially when we want to build our Black Wall Street districts. And I do feel proud that 3 years ago we only had one Black Wall Street district. And now today we're looking at 16 Black Wall Street districts. Many are at different levels, but when the Chicago Urban League made the comment that Chicago will be the next Black Wall Street district, I don't think they knew what they were professing to be where we are today. So with the weight of the spirit of the Black Wall Street districts, along with all the implementation and the organizing that we have to do to do it with the limited resources, I feel good of our committee and our board that stand very focused on what we have to do, not only here in Chicago, but as we prepare to get ready for the summit, national summit, that's going to be held in Gary, Indiana in October of this year. So we got a heavy agenda, Sonia, and we got to, as much as you do, with the Chicago's Black Business Network, we're going to sneak around the corner and grab you.
You're listening to Black Wall Street USA with Chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago, Ron Carter, and Sonia Perdue is co-host for this segment. Ron, let's take a short break, and we're going to be right back and talk about Black Wall Street in just a little bit more. Thank you so much for being with us this evening and being a part of sustaining and increasing black businesses.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. A new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world, and a bold world for me. Yeah, yeah. Stars, when you shine, you know
Listen to Black Wall Street USA. I'm Sonia Cassandra Perdue, the co-host for this segment. Ron Carter, chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago, will be back with us shortly. Want to remind you that we're here every Thursday evening, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. We invite you to be part of sustaining and increasing black businesses. Our call-in number is 347-326-9477. The chat room is open. Leave your company information in the chat room. Press the number 1 if you'd like to speak to our host or if you have a question or comment. Want to also remind you that CBBN on Blog Talk Radio is on the air every Tuesday evening with the CBBN Members Show at 6:30 p.m. and the Consumer Show at 7:30 p.m. with attorney and CPA Derek McNeil. Please call in and be a part of all that we're doing. I want to remind you, we are having a business planning meeting for CBBN March 12th at the King Branch Library located at 35th and King Drive. It is open to the public, and we certainly want you to be a part of all that we do. I'm going to bring the chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago on the line, and I'm thinking that this is our national president, Michael Carter, out of Oakland on the line. Welcome back to the show, Ron. Welcome to the show, Michael Carter.
Good evening.
Good evening, Michael Carter. Talked to you earlier today, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Didn't I talk to you yesterday or the day before then, too?
We've been talking a whole lot lately.
Are we going to start talking a lot more than we used to nowadays?
So I'm going to be in your ear and let you know what's going on around the country. I'm just happy. But, you know, before I even touch bases on the convention and what you got coming up, I just have to say, anybody in Chicago, if you have not been at least to the grave site of Brother Emmett Till and Al Sip, I encourage you. That was one of the things I wanted to do in college. And you know, the story and the fact that his mother insisted that his coffin was open, that was a message to be sent down through the generation. And I call that a Jesus-type message, because what Jesus did was he sent parables and made examples and expounded on things so that it would last well past his physical lifetime and well past his disciples' lifetime and the beginning of the church. And so for his mother to insist that his coffin was open so that the world could see the venom and the hate and the degradation that our people have suffered in this nation just on the body of a 14-year-old boy, that sent reverberations throughout the globe. It sent a message as to who America at that time really was and how racism festered and how it was a pinnacle point. Yes, the way he died was horrible, and how they chose him arbitrarily was horrible, because it was the way white folks viewed black folks, and that had to send a wave across the world, not just in America, that America has not changed in 55, and then what did it do? It started a movement. And it is, I don't know, it has to be divine intervention that his body is in the state of Illinois, because Illinois has really taken on this spirit of Tulsa in a way that other cities are looking at. So So I just wanted to, you know, Reverend Parker, he touched my heart. But I encourage, you know, everybody listening to, you know, read up on that story. It's what America was, and to some degree we're still there.
So when you, one thing, so you were listening in on Reverend Parker during the interview?
Absolutely.
Okay, so how do you relate our role today as a being as relates to Black Wall Street? Again, the if we can say the how can I put it? I don't know if it was the whistle or the contact with a Caucasian woman resulted in the destruction of Black economics. I don't know if that's a good analysis.
But I know where you're going with that. It's not about Black economics. This is about a very evil and unholy spirit that had you know crept into the hearts and minds of those who the Jim Crow era and his grandson and his great grandson and hatred. It just so happened to interrupt the economic flow. And hatred is at the root of it, Ron. It you can't, you know, pinpoint it in any one direction. But now there is a similarity in the fact that he was accused of trying to talk to a white woman. Now, remember, the white woman is the white man's precious jewel. And anything that resembles Afroid features or background attacking, it's just a big bugaboo for white men to see, you know, a white girl with a black man. Although these white fathers send their daughters to these college campuses and damn near kidnap these black athletes, you know, to trail them in case they make a lot of money. And that's just an attempt to keep the money in the white community, but it is what it is. Dick Rowland was accused of grabbing the arm or trying to rape or make a pass at Sarah Page, which sparked the riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His name was Dick Rowland, and her name was Sarah Page, who was an elevator operator, and that just escalated into, you know, tit for tat, who's the strongest, and all of this stuff between the black men and the white men in that day. The riot came about because, you know, a black man took a gun from a white man. He didn't like it, so he shot him. And that's how the riot started. But at the root of it, it's really not about the white girl and the black boy. It's about hatred. And
Let me ask you, what could be the difference, or is there a difference between the movement of Black Wall Street compared to the movement of Marcus Garvey, the movement of Elijah Muhammad, and Malcolm X, based on all four head, is it a sense of black nationalism that drives Black Wall Street versus Marcus Garvey versus Malcolm X versus black nationalism? Is there a similarity, or if all of those three movements separate to themselves?
Well, I always go to the root of what those movements represented. Now, you know, you had the Marcus Garvey movement, you know, the red, the black, the green, wanting to go back to Africa, connect with our motherland. Well, now let's back up. There was a spirit behind that. Now you have the movement with Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you know, do for self, how to eat to live. You know, there's protocol. Now you have Minister Louis Farrakhan. But at the root of it, I don't care. If you hear Minister Farrakhan talk, he always has something to say about back home or his West Indian mother and the spirit that she generated in him. So for me as a minister, first, I must deal with the spirit. So what was the spirit? The spirit behind all of those movements was, if white folks can have success economically, free will and, you know, civil rights and the right to vote, why can't we, you see? But there's a spirit behind making that happen. Now, what I teach young people is don't get caught up on the civil rights movement. There's more to it than that. Before our ancestors were even able to even have any semblance of freedom, there had to have been a spiritual movement in our ancestors. In other words, those who worked in the cotton fields and the tobacco fields, there was a spirit, but they didn't control education in America. They didn't control communications, intermodal, the railroads. They were working in the fields and on the farms and on the plantations. They did not have access to power. All they had was God. So therefore, there had to be a spiritual movement. So I don't want to hear people talk about, well, I was around during the civil rights movement. Well, that's fine, but you must understand something had to happen with God first. And that spirit had to be right. So when you have a Marcus Garvey, when you have a Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Minister Louis Farrakhan, and Stokely Carmichael, and Medgar Evers, and Primus King, and you know all of these people who lead movements, there is a spirit behind it. Now, the SCLC has a role. The Urban League has a role. The NAACP has a role. Well, like most humans, that spirit can die in some of those organizations, and they no longer effective. But the spirit never dies. It always finds some place to take up residence. And what it has done is through you and Sonia and the district leaders around the country, they say, hey, well, now that we know about this Black Wall Street and the spirit of what it was really all about, I'm going to take on that spirit. And it's really a spirit of God, to be honest with you, but they say, I'm going to take on the spirit, and then the spirit causes the movement. The spirit causes whatever movement, you can call it whatever you want. You can put any leader on top of it that you'd like. But now, for humanity, as far as my belief goes, the first movement for humanity in order to get back into good graces with God, that movement had to have been led by Jesus Christ, in my view. Now, that's my personal view.
Right. Well, now, as I asked the question regarding those movements that have a singular theme of self-help or black businesses, you're right. All of them have a root to their spirituality, even to the point as you being the leader of the National Black Wall Street USA. All of them have that spiritual root. Taking that in consideration, and this is coming to be the second anniversary of the second annual convention of the Black Wall Street USA, how do those entities that still exist, that are still followers of Marcus Garvey, there's still followers of Elijah Muhammad from Louis Farrakhan. There's still those that believe in the economic direction of Malcolm X. And then there is the Black Wall Street. How or do the Black Wall Street pull those resources of those same individuals that have the roots of spirituality that drives their mission with the basis of self-sustaining a people? How or is that the role of Black Wall Street USA to make that happen?
My vision, the vision that God has given me, Ron, is to have a Black Wall Street district somewhere in this country, in the hood or in the black neighborhood, where you own one block, and on this one block, you have the office for the Nation of Islam. You have the Urban League office, the NAACP office. Now, not downtown, not in the plush, nice Beverly Hill type neighborhood. I'm talking about on Crenshaw, or on Imperial in San Diego, or on University in Seattle, or on East 75th Street in Chicago, or on South 9th Street in Newark. Wherever we have a Black Wall Street, I envision a block where the offices of, you know, SCLC and Urban League, all of them are right there. So then what that means is that a teenager, Emmett Till's age, when he walk out of his house in the Chatham District in Chicago and he go down East 75th Street, he got every last one of them organizations right there in his neighborhood, a satellite office. And nowadays we have the Internet, you know, they really trying to close offices or whatever, but that's my vision because, see, each one of those organizations has something to bring to the table. You know, I said the other night to one brother that works with us, if I had asked the Lord for anything, I would have loved to have been able to just walk down Greenwood Arch and Pine in Tulsa just for a day, one day in my life before it was destroyed, to see Mount Zion and the theater, the Dreamland Theater and all of that. If I could just have one day prior to June 1st, 1921, in that little 36-square-block area, there were black organizations working together. The organizations did different things, and it's on the website as to what they did. That's my vision. That's the vision here, because our young people deserve to be able to walk out of the door in their neighborhood and have a National Action Network satellite office right there in their neighborhood. See, until we get there, I'm not interested in how affirmative active one generation of black folks was to be able to contract with the state.
Are those individuals going to be outreach, and have they been communicated with that vision, or that's just something in the process that needs to happen, or to bring that to their attention?
It needs to happen, and it's not happening. 85% of what you call black events are outside of the areas where African Americans live, like the expos and the summits and conferences and things of that nature, which would put money into the black community. Sororities and fraternities have their events at, you know, nice hotels, and that's fine, do your thing. But the bottom line is our young people need to see, you know, we talk about these organizations, we talk about these leaders, we talk about what has been done, but it's not reflected in the places where young people live. And so we welcome, again, we welcome any organization, especially those who are deeply rooted in the African-American community, to join us. But our organization is not a political organization or a organization that's trying to rally to become some huge black organization. No, this is governed by the Spirit. And everyone who is a district leader, where there's a Black Wall Street district in this nation, Black Wall Street National did not go recruit them. They came to us. Why? Because they were in the Spirit already. We were in the Spirit already. There was no need for a meeting. We connected. And that is the spirit of it. Now, I don't care what their resume says or where they've been in the world. I've been to 38 countries. That makes me no more important than anyone else. So none of that matters. What matters is, Ron, is that when that woman called me from Columbus, Mississippi, right on the border of Alabama, from a radio station, she hollered so loud, Columbus wants a Black Wall Street district, you see, because they are already in the spirit in Columbus, Mississippi. In Sacramento.
How are we looking now as moving to the national convention that will be in Gary, Indiana on October. How many districts around the country we have now?
Well, now, let's see. It seems like every month you've given birth to one. So there are approximately 20. If I heard your numbers right earlier, if you added one more, there's 27. And to run them down, you can go on the national website, blackwallstreet.org or blackwallstreetdistrict.com, and count them yourself. But Chicago, in Chicagoland, has, I think you said 16. So you got East Coast, Newark, and Atlanta. West Coast is San Diego, Los Angeles, thanks to Sonya. And then the sister that was heading San Diego, she went on and established it. They're off and running. And so she's going to go to Sacramento and establish one there, and in Oakland, of course, and Seattle. Baton Rouge, and let's see, I'm missing somebody, but 26 or 27.
So what's going to happen at this national convention in October? I mean, we're going to have these Black Wall Streets from around the country come together at this national summit or convention. What's going to be the result after everybody leaves?
Well, the first priority, very first priority, is to introduce other district leaders around the country to one another or representatives. And then, for example, the group in Newark, New Jersey, they came on last year just before the convention. They're going to share how they're refurbishing homes. If you go to the national site, you'll see a video of them from MSNBC, how they refurbish homes for the working class. It's economics, but it's not, you know, putting up retail everywhere. They want to establish the home, the neighborhood first, then that will create the retail flow of dollars. Well, we're going to take Newark's example, and they'll introduce that to all the other districts. Whatever San Diego is doing, the bishop there, Bishop McKinney, just received approval to build a convention center and a retail strip and a parking lot garage right across from where he has a $10 million senior housing in that little corridor on Imperial. So each district will share their models of what works.
Now,
in
is that going to be, now we understand it's going to be in Gary, Indiana, at the Jenner Center. That's October the 20, what's that, 21st?
21st through the 23rd? Yes, and then this year, 21st through the 23rd, and this year we want to make sure that we have on Sunday the tours of the Gary and Chicago districts, as many as we can hit, since so many are coming on.
Is this a convention? Is this a convention where the different districts go on to display their banners of Washington, Oakland, San Diego, Chicago, 75th Street, Chicago,
Yeah, and Chicago gonna have half the flow, because you guys are.
Well, he's that way. Is that the sense of the convention? Where, you know, typical conventions where representatives from each area are showing their banners, giving their reports. Is that the feel of it, or what would be the feel of it? What could people expect? Or even to the point that people that are not part of a Black Wall Street district, why would they want to come?
Well, now let me just share this with you. Ricky Cease, who is the chairperson for Gary, we were talking, and he was saying how surprised he was that very few people knew about Black Wall Street Tulsa. And so we must understand that this is, at first of all, you're on the right track as to the dynamics of a convention. But this is an educational piece.
Chairman, we almost are out of time, so okay. Sonya going to kick my booty, because I ain't give her enough time to do what she got to do. Give us a reel in 2 minutes.
All right.
And I'll tell you what, not 2 minutes. Let's try to wrap this up in the next, 2 minutes.
Okay, all I need is a minute. Look, this is what I want folks to do. First of all, for those of you who don't have a district in your community, you still can join the organization. Go to blackwallstreet.org or blackwallstreetdistrict.com and join. And then for those of you who want to attend the convention, go there and register for the convention. Do that now. And also, we want to encourage those who are already members of whatever district you are around the country to pay your dues and to support what we're doing. But go to blackwallstreetdistrict.com, watch the videos, download whatever you need to download. And finally, I encourage any businesses out there that are listening, you need to support this show. Call Sonya. Get your ad on the air. We want to have more breaks where she got to go tell Ron stop talking so much because we got these advertisers. That's what I want to hear. I want you to advertise on this show. This is how we're going to keep this thing going. Sonya has the drums, and we want her to beat her drums. And so if Ricky Cease is listening and his team, give me a call so I can update you. Ron, thank you for all that you do. And tell Mark Allen and all the rest of them that I really appreciate what they're doing.
Well, look, we appreciate you for having a vision that has spread seeds all over this nation. And I think at one point, I thought I heard you say something about Black Wall Street in South Africa.
Yeah. You have videos there as well. And the Council General.
I want to ask you, is South Africa already a Black Wall Street? But again, that goes back to the spirit of the impression of South Africa as well. So, Brother Reverend Carter, Michael Carter, we appreciate you. And as I said in the beginning, I think we're all going to start talking a lot more with each other as we build this movement for Black Wall Street. So let's stay in touch. And I want to bring on our dear sister, Sonya, and maybe I can blame it on the preacher. Sonya?
You can blame. I'm getting smarter, Mr. Carter. You listen to Black Wall Street USA with Sonya Perdue, our host Ron Carter, chairman of Black Wall Street Chicago, and our national president, Michael Carter. You gave me my 2 minutes, but you know what? Area code 219, you're on the air. Who's on the line from 219?
Ricky Cease.
Oh.
Hi, Ricky. How are you?
You got
60 seconds to say hello to everybody.
hello, everybody. This is my first time on the call, and I want to say that I'm impressed and super excited.
Very great. Glad you called in. You're going to be asked to come on a lot more as Gary hosts the second Black Wall Street convention in October.
Well, you know what? Let me say this real quick. When Michael said that if he can go back into 1921 and just have a day, when I looked again at that YouTube and I looked at all 12 segments, and I promise you, honest to God, I said, Lord, I wish that I can go back there in that day, in that time, and walk through that myself. I just said that. So when he said that, I was like, wow, because I share that same sentiment. I wish I can go back and see that.
Ricky, we want to thank you for this call of spirit. We want to thank you for being a part of Black Wall Street USA. Tune in next week. We're here every Thursday evening from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Gentlemen, thank you for reaching out around the world. We appreciate you. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.